are listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM. This month we are talking love stories, from the conventional to the non-conventional to the controversial. We hear from London poet Afflee Johnson about how her love poetry has changed as her perception and expectations of love has. I talk to local writer Jennifer Hewitt, who's working on a screenplay which explores polyamory, queer identity and friendship. I talk to local author Joanna Rees, whose new book, The Hidden Wife, is out now on ebook. And we discuss the strengths and pitfalls of Call Me By Your Name by Andre Ackerman with two local book bloggers. The Brighton Book Club is also a podcast, which you can subscribe and download from wherever you get yours. We're available on Apple Music, Spotify, and most other platforms. We also have an Instagram page at BTN Book Club. And if you'd like to get in touch about the show or have any suggestions, you can email me at btnbookclub@gmail.com. Today's show is a really special one, and I'm really excited to share it with you. So here we go. I am joined in the virtual Brighton Book Club studio by my friend Afflee Johnson, who is a poet and a writer living in London. Afflee, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Afflee, this week on the Book Club, we're talking about everything to do with love. When I say, what do you think about when you think about love in literature? What do you think about?
Weirdly, I think of like my childhood self. I felt like when I was young, maybe 12, 13, I read all of the Jane Austen books. I was obsessed with Romeo and Juliet, and like I built my idea of what love should and would be from those stories. And the older I get, the more I realize it's nothing like that at all. And it's actually kind of a letdown. And my whole adult life has kind of been a journey of unlearning that like hero narrative. Like, no one is coming to save me.
Absolutely. I think that's so interesting and something we're going to talk about. Actually, we could talk about it now, about the kind of curriculum that we grow up with. So obviously you're a poet, and what I'm really interested in is how we can engage like reluctant and younger readers to get into prose and to get into poetry and to start writing. The syllabus as it is, or at least was when we were younger, was very old-fashioned, very white, very kind of colonial. What do you think needs to happen? So obviously something needs to change. And what kind of poetry would you like to have seen in the curriculum, and what kind of books would you have liked to see in the curriculum when you were younger?
Yeah, there's a long, long way to go, I feel like, with the curriculum. But to me, the writers that stood out, in fact, there was only one poet, Benjamin Zephaniah, which I think was part of our GCSE syllabus. And mm-hmm. I still remember that poem in amongst all of the other stuff that everyone read. And I feel like we just need, even if it was just a few more, like I'm not saying you have to change the entire curriculum from today, but I just don't think it would take a lot to add in a few more authors from non-white backgrounds mm-hmm. and just start from there. And I guess it also in the beginning needs teachers to be trained in how to teach those subjects, and ideally a more diverse sort of teaching staff would be great. I feel like it would have made me feel so much safer and more seen if I'd been able to read books written by people who looked like me, basically. Absolutely. Like my mum gave them to me. So people like Zadie Smith, I was obsessed with, because I was like, oh, if she can do it, then I can do it. Mm-hmm. And that's basically why I'm a writer now.
Because of Zadie Smith.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And so basically all it can take is just one author, one poet to inspire kids that aren't from, you know, white backgrounds to realise that there is something beyond that, that you don't have to be an old white bloke to be a writer or a poet.
Yeah, and maybe they could include a bit more contemporary writing. Mm-hmm. I know that a lot of people, when I talk to them about poetry, they say, oh, I never understood it mm-hmm. because they couldn't get into Shakespeare, or they couldn't get into Wordsworth, because the language is so different and like removed to how we speak now. Mm. Whereas if you read contemporary poetry, I find it a lot easier to read because it's written in language that I speak in and that I write in now.
Can you read us a couple of your poems, Afflee? A couple of your love poems?
I would love to read you a couple of my love poems.
Thank you.
I'm going to start with the first love poem I wrote when I fell in love for the first time. I'd written love poems before that, but they were all terrible, and also I had no idea what love was. It's very short and it goes like this. I dribbled on your chest in the night. The wetness on my palm woke me, but I wiped it on your arm and rolled over.
And that was your first love poem?
That was my first love.
And when did you write it?
First year of uni.
First year of uni.
Yeah.
So how has the way that you write love poetry changed in the last 6, 7 years since you started?
In the last 6, 7 years? In a nutshell, I guess I've figured out in the last 6 or 7 years what love is. So that has really sort of reshaped how I've written. So most of the poems in the last 5 years were about directing love towards other people and sort of examining the love that was coming in my direction, but externally. So from my parents or my partner at the time. But in the last year, I kind of came to the understanding that the most important and probably the most elusive love is self-love, quote unquote. And I find it really difficult. I don't really understand what it is. I thought it just meant a general like acceptance of yourself, feeling like you're not a person, maybe liking your hair occasionally.
I thought it meant having a bath.
Yeah, having a bath, I don't know. But actually it turns out it's like my therapist calls it a knowing, an active knowing, and it like exists in the fibers of your being or something. I don't know.
Okay.
This poem is about that.
Amazing.
That listless, no love life was burning me all over. Your sad, sweaty dreams wet me all over. On grit, we tumbled to our knees, had a coffee to make the panic real, cut each other out like cereal coupons. It was all strange and cardboard aching. Now, roll over ointment, piece the flank skin back together with WhatsApp, watch this. An ice cream washed ashore, crispy cone intact, the thick cream whip in point. Each lick keeps the loving mind in joy. Saccharine, ice cream breath, exhaled all over my upper lip, I can smell it. Give it time, find your joy, try something new, pick up a hobby, get under somebody. I want a whole year of feeling ice cream dream. I'm so shallow, tap no on everyone, it's a match. I hate you for making me be on here. Stop the bus. My love is gone, my hands are wet, I threw them out. Plunge me into open water. Rinse me of sad sin. Watch this. An ice cream washed ashore. Crispy cone intact. The thick cream whip in point. Each lick keeps the loving mind in joy. Saccharine, ice cream breath exhaled all over my upper lip. I can smell it.
I absolutely love that. That is so good. You're so talented, Af. So I want to ask you a little bit about Say It Back, because Say It Back is something that you have co-founded. Why don't you just tell me about Say It Back?
Say It Back is the baby of myself and our mutual friend Elisa Legstina, who's also a musician. We started it about a year and a half ago. It's essentially a poetry community, and we throw live events, open mic events, and we teach workshops to young people and adults around London. And the idea of it basically is that it's a safe space. So we prioritize the voices of queer poets, of black poets, of people of color, and like anyone and everyone is welcome to join. But you basically have to bring your most vulnerable and authentic self if you can.
And how has it translated to these COVID times?
Well, we obviously can't do anything in real life anymore. So we've moved. We did a couple of Instagram lives, but that's a little bit tricky. So the last two sessions that we've done have been on Zoom. So we did a poetry circle last week, where we featured all black poets and all black poets on the open mic too, because that was sort of like the peak of that really super intense period of all the killings and all of the protests, and we wanted to kind of create a space for these young people to come and just sort of like vent a little bit.
It was so moving.
Oh yeah, you were there.
Yeah, I was. It was absolutely, I didn't have my camera on, but it was
a really amazing and really accessible event, and it's just such a good way to listen and learn and like just hear these amazing creative voices basically, and just take some time out of your day to do it. So I would recommend that everybody follow Say It Back. How can we find you guys?
Please, we are at Say It Back LDN on Instagram, and we're actually doing a live on Thursday night from 7:30 for Pride.
That's Thursday the 25th.
Thursday the 25th, yeah.
Excellent. And after that, when will it be?
I don't know yet.
But follow Say It Back.
2 weeks after that, yeah. Amazing. We're trying to do something every 2 weeks.
Thank you so much for coming on the Brighton Book Club today. And please promise me when we're allowed out that you will come down to the studio with Aliza and record some poetry with us in the studio. That would be amazing.
Please, I would love to. We would love to.
Speaking on her behalf. Can you please outro yourself with another one of your wonderful poems?
Yeah. So this poem I wrote last year, and it's kind of about the relationship I imagine that I will be in when I'm a grown up, even though I'm 29. But I imagine at some point I will meet the person and we will build this family. And this is sort of like the imaginary utopia that I hope that we build. I imagine us older here, padding across warm floor tiles, performing small gestures at the end of a family day. We clear space for one another, never perfect space, but all the days of loving are evidence for knowing what to say and when. All the days of loving carry us to bed like the first time, love and terror in a single bed. All the days of loving, all the better days, birthdays, days outside in green space, beachy hair days, bed days, get off days, come back days, don't stop days, stand up and clap days, wind me up days, make me wind days, all these loving days. I imagine us older here, rolling across the rugs to wash the plates, stitching the kernels of old receipts, the milky sun in our windows, all these days, all these loving days.
Jennifer Drewitt, welcome to the Brighton Book Club. Please, can you introduce yourself for our listener today?
Hello, my name is Jennifer Drewitt. I am a businesswoman based in the eastern part of Brighton, and I'm also a writer.
You are also a writer, and we are going to come on to that in a second. But firstly, I would like to know what your favourite love stories are.
Oh, goodness. I grew up on a lot of different sort of love stories. One of my favourites has to be Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. I am a sucker for Mr. Darcy and Elizabeth Bennet, partly because they grow as a couple together, like kind of together, but also apart, and they sort of force each other to face their worst parts in a way. And it's just, and also I just absolutely love the 1995 adaptation. Is absolutely beautiful, but I think my other favourite would be basically all the love stories in Little Women as well. I grew up reading that as well, and it was just the different love stories, not just the romantic stories, but also like the platonic stories and the familial love as well. It's just all about so much love, and it has definitely guided me somewhat as I grew up.
So Jennifer, you're working on a screenplay at the moment, aren't you? And I was so excited when you got in contact with me about this because it sounds completely original and completely excellent. Can you tell us a bit about it?
So this story is a film script I'm working on, and it's about these three friends, and they go through their own sort of romance stories, but it's set across comic cons. So it's set across three different comic cons, and they all go through their own exploration. So one has to decide between his long-term girlfriend and his best friend. The other is finding herself. And the other has to choose between reality and fantasy. But will they actually be able to go through this together, or will it tear them apart? Who knows?
That's such a great pitch. So what I'm really interested in, and we've been talking about on the show, is the kind of love stories and the kind of stories in general that we grow up with and that are taught to us at school. So you write disabled characters, and you also write LGBT plus characters. And why do you think particularly that representation is really important? And are we heading in the right direction at the moment?
I think, well, to the first part, I think statistically speaking, when particularly when children see themselves on television, in films, in books, it helps to normalize, and it helps them as they grow up, particularly ones from minority identities. I know that it was difficult for me as a disabled woman finding almost no role models who were like me in any way. You know, there weren't really autistic women in the movies. There weren't any autistic women being written about, bar maybe Donna Williams at a stretch for adults. So I was a bit too young. And with LGBT stuff, it's a bit better in that front. But even then, I grew up in the 90s and the early noughts where homophobia was still very unfortunately rampant. So I do feel that whilst we are starting to get in the right direction in terms of representation, we're going about it all too slowly. People within the communities that need represent wage might have some good anecdotes and might have some valuable insight, but you've actually got to speak to the people who have the disabilities themselves, because otherwise you just end up with really sort of, you know, really cliched, tropey stuff that it does a lot more harm than good.
Have there been examples that you've seen recently in TV, film or books that you feel have actually done a real disservice to the disabled community?
There's a couple of American films I wish I could remember the name of, but this is particularly a problem in American media where people who particularly who are mentally disabled are represented as just being stupid. The two seem to find together, which is so infuriating. The one that haunts me throughout my lifetime is not that recent, is Rain Man. Rain Man came out when I was born, and it was a decent representation at the time of autistic savants, which make up less than 5% of autistic people. So not that fantastic. And I don't think the filmmakers went at it with bad intent. I think they wanted to do something good. But at the same time, I've lived my life and gone, oh, you're autistic, so you're like Rain Man, are you?
You must be really good at maths and all that.
Yeah, I must be really good at maths. It's like, yeah, I barely scraped a C in maths GCSE. I was not good at maths. Or, oh, you must be really good at like drawing things or counting cards. I'm like, yeah, don't take me to a casino and try that one. I can't count cards. I'm not very good at drawing. I'm not good at science. I'm like, just all the stereotypes, again, created far more harm than good.
Yeah, I think that's such a good point and something that so many writers really need to take into account. And just because you've heard a story about someone that might have, that, you know, that something might have happened at some point in history, that cannot be used to represent a whole community of people. Can you read us, Jennifer, just a little bit from your screenplay? I would love to hear some.
I can. So so the scene is at a bar. Leo and Mal come into the bar area. It's relatively quiet, with bartender at the bar cleaning glasses. There is a trio of friends at the bar talking to each other with a few glasses and a wine bottle. Leo and Mal look around the bar. They spot Polly, who is sat alone reading a book. They head over. Polly! Polly moves her attention from her book to see who called her. She sees Leo and Mal. This causes her to smile. Leo, Mal, my favourite knights. Polly puts her book down. She stands up and hugs Leo and Mal separately. They sit at the table Polly was at before. How are you two? Great. We just saw the arrival of Mr. and Mrs. Heterodysfunction. Oh, anything broken yet? They were quite quiet, but it's only a matter of time. I'd be shocked if something doesn't go south during Comic-Con tomorrow. I don't know. Jamie told me that Sean got dragged into doing a couple's cosplay with her, so maybe they'll be quietly tense. Oh, shoot, which couple? Well, no idea, but I can't wait to find out. Same. Weren't you going to bring that guy with you this weekend? Don something, Polly? Oh, nah. Well, he seemed more interested in satisfying his car than anything with me. There's only so much a pretty face can compensate for. Well, you're better off without then. Well, quite right. Hey, look, I'm a little bit tired, guys. I'm going to have to go to bed. Okay, well, tomorrow I'll be buried in cosplay competition prep, but Leo will be around. Yeah, well, do you want to head into con together? Well, that'd be great. See you at breakfast? Yeah. Good night, Paul. Night. Polly grabs her book, gets up and leaves.
That is so engaging and really fun, Jennifer. Thank you for sharing. So the relationships in this screenplay aren't necessarily straightforward. Can you talk a little bit about how you've kind of subverted traditional love stories in your screenplay?
So one of the big decisions I made was I was keen to subvert a lot of these sort of LGBT cliches and tropes. Things like, you know, the catty sort of gay man couple and stuff like that. Most of the characters that are named are in some way LGBT. So one of the main characters is non-binary. The most stable relationship is two gay guys, which is a complete subversion to normal. I've also introduced polyamory into the mix. So one of the other most stable relationships is a polyamorous relationship. And they're really stable. There's no, oh, you're looking at this person and, oh, there's this intrigue thing. And, oh, we have to get with everyone we lay our eyes on. You know, there's a lot of stability in the places that traditionally are represented as unstable.
That's so good and so refreshing. And I think that definitely books and TV are slowly heading in the direction of showing less conventional relationships, but there is still a lot more ground to be covered. So what do you ultimately want for this screenplay, Jennifer? What's your dream?
Oh, well, I want to be able to make it. Mm-hmm. more than anything else in the world, I would absolutely love to be able to make it. And I'd also want it to be part of that change where actually people who particularly are in polyamorous relationships can look at that and go, yeah, that's an example of a polyamorous relationship that can work. It's not all about sort of, you know, sexual intrigue. It's actually just people who happen to love each other who happen to be polyamorous. You know, I want LGBT youth to be able to look at that and go, oh right, oh, that's what it's like. Oh, it's not all this, that, and the other. Actually, I can be happy and I can just find someone and be very happy. You know, I want also disabled folk to be able to look at, because one of the characters, supporting characters, one of the love interests of the first main character is disabled. She's an ambulatory wheelchair user. So sometimes she uses a wheelchair and sometimes she uses a walking stick. And I want some people who are like that. I'm an ambulatory wheelchair user and a lot of my friends are. Or not them to look at that and go, oh yeah, we're not just, you know, disabled, we're fully rounded human beings. Like, that's great, you know?
But yeah, absolutely. Well, really, really good luck to you, Jennifer. And before you go, you run a really lovely brand, don't you? Can you just talk a little bit about that and how we can find and follow you and buy your lovely products?
Thank you. So my business is called Coronation Soap. I make handmade vegan soaps, lip balms, candles, and I also make resin pieces. So I do a bit of art. I make coasters, ashtrays, all sorts of things. I can be found on www.coronationsoap.uk. That's www.coronationsoap.uk.
I am really excited to have a prolific Brighton author, Joanna Rees, with me in the virtual Brighton Book Club studio on a very sunny Tuesday, is it, Joanna? Please, can you introduce yourself to our listeners and tell us a bit about your work?
Yes, well, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you very much for having me on the show. I write as Joanna Rees. As you said, I've got some books that I'm writing at the moment that were all set in the 1920s. So I'm channeling my inner flapper girl, basically. That's my excuse. But I also write as Josie Lloyd, and I started off writing 20 years ago. I wrote a book called It Could Be You, and I had no idea what I was doing. I just decided that I had to write a novel. So I sought myself out, jacked in my job, wrote this book, and then I met Emlyn, my husband, because he was my agent's assistant. And we landed up getting together to write a book called Come Together. When he wrote the boy's point of view and I wrote the girl's point of view of a relationship. That happened way back in the last century, I can tell you, very long time ago. Anyway, that was published in 1999 and it went on to be a big hit, and it was published in lots of different languages and was made into a film. And as a result of writing that book, Emily and I got together. And so we wrote seven more novels together. sort of rom-coms, although he's a bit of a thriller writer, so he's naturally a thriller writer, so he's always trying to get a body into the basement or under the patio. Anyway, so we did that for quite a while, and then I write big women's commercial fiction books as Joanna Rees, and he writes thrillers, so he did get to bury bodies again, but we also write parodies together. So we're going on a bar hunt and the very hungover caterpillar and the teenager who came to tea and various other funny kind of gifty type books that make us laugh. So that's where we're up to.
So really, I mean, this is very appropriate for our story, for our episode about love stories, because this is like a real life love story playing out in your whole careers, really, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, it was a big chat up line. Would you like to write a novel with me? Actually, what happened was he was writing his first novel, and he'd written a thriller and it'd just been published, and I had just was just publishing my first novel. And this was back in the day, before online dating, before mobile phones. And we used to kind of meet up to chat about our lives. And he was having this hilarious 20-something single life in London, as was I. But he had a very funny boy's take on it, and I had the girl's take on it. And he said, well, why don't we try? At the time, there was nothing that was sort of 20-something fiction. Chick Lit hadn't been born at that point. And there was nothing really for our age group that was about us. And he said to me, we got very drunk one night, and he said to me, we should write this down, this is really funny, shall we do it? And the next morning, I remember it so clearly, I was standing in my flat and I was so hungover, and he rang me up from the office, and he went, do you remember what we were talking about last night? And I went, oh god, what did I say? And he said, do you want to write a book with me? And I said, yes. And you know, sometimes in your life you say yes and it kind of has a profound effect. That was one of the yeses. So I landed up writing a book with him, and he went away with all his mates and he wrote the first chapter of this character called Jack, who was a bit of a Jack the Lad and was always on the pool for girls. And he landed it up on the cliffhanger where Jack has seen this girl in a nightclub. He doesn't describe her at all. And he taps her on the shoulder and says, hello, my name is Jack. And she turns around. And then it was over to me. So then he handed it over to me. And I had to, and his chapter really made me laugh. I mean, that was the whole thing, that it made me laugh. So then I rolled up my sleeves and I wrote Amy in response. And we wrote this story together, a chapter at a time. And so I would give him my chapter, and then he would do something and I'd go, what has he done to my Amy? He can't do that. And I'd roll up my sleeves and write a reply. So it was kind of this novel of letters, which was it was really exciting way to write. And we got to know each other very well as a result of it. But whilst we were writing this warts and all book about 20-somethings who jump into bed together and then deal with the fallout and actually then make an emotional connection, we were behaving like Victorians writing a novel of letters, because we got a big book deal on the first two chapters. And so everybody said, oh my god, this is your big chance, you've got a big book deal, you're going to be with this guy writing for 2 years, you know, you can't get together with him, this is, you know, very much a professional relationship. But all the time we were kind of getting to know each other really well, and so it got to nearly the end of the book before we actually got together. So it was quite romantic, I have to say.
Actually, yeah, a bit emotional. It's lovely.
So that was that. And it's a really great way of writing, actually. I found that writing with him over the years, and actually still, even though we write separate books now, we still edit each other's work, and we kind of still, he is still my first reader. And actually, it's very nice having somebody that you really care what they think, because it makes your writing a bit better, I think.
Absolutely.
And you can't, we had to get some writing rules in place quite early on. So it had to be that you can't hand over any work unless it's absolutely the best it can possibly be. And it's been quite hard to learn how to give and take feedback, but we get there eventually.
Absolutely. And not just make passive aggressive snips at each other over dinner.
No. But we're both writers. Our children think it's hilarious, because we both have this thing we call book heads. So one of us will be completely involved in a book and then staring off into the distance whilst we're trying to eat pastel, and we're like, go on, just go write it down. Or we'll get up in the middle of the night and some people furiously trying to find a pen going, oh, I've got a bit of dialogue. So yeah, it's quite funny.
So, I mean, I could just ask you a million questions about that. You have got a book that has recently been released on ebook and is going to be released in paperback in March. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, so this is the second book of my trilogy, and it's all set in Paris in 1928, and it's called Hidden Wife, and it carries on the story. You don't have to have read the first one, but it carries on the story of my runaway daughter, Vita, who has run away from, she's got a horrible brother, basically, this girl, and she's at this point in her life where she's run away to London, she's become a flapper girl, and so she's a dancer in a club, and she's kind of swooped up by this amazing kind of charismatic gregarious girl called Nancy, and Vita, my character, starts designing bras. She's like a big bra. Bras were about to be born then, and she's a dancer and she's a bit too well endowed to be the kind of flapper girl thing, so she designs this underwear. Anyway, the story takes her to Paris, where she starts working for an amazing couturier. And actually, what was so interesting about this book was that I was researching it thinking, God, I really need her to write, I really need my character to work for somebody who's in fashion in Paris in the 1920s. Of course, Chanel springs to mind, but everybody knows quite a lot about Coco Chanel. Anyway, so I did some research, Googling, and I found this amazing Vogue article written at that time about this woman called Jenny Sacerdote, who was this huge couturier in Paris, and she had 22 ateliers working for her, and she had these huge offices on the Champs-Élysées, and she used to dress the Empress of Japan and the Queen of Egypt, and she and Fred Astaire's sister and mother, everybody came to her salon. And anyway, so I Googled it, and I saw that there was still a company going called Jenny Sacerdote. So I wrote this, excuse me, I'm an author from Brighton. Would you mind with a bit of information? And I got this incredible response back from this woman called Anne, who is the CEO of Jenny Sacerdote, who told me this amazing story of this woman who became, at the age of 30, she decided that she was going to get into fashion. She became this huge celebrity. And I went to Paris to meet her, and I went to all the old kind of places. And she is now the Jenny Sacerdote kind of, when the war came, she was quite old, and she didn't have any descendants. So the brand fell away and just stopped existing. And 100 years later, Anna's brought it back to life. She's bought the brand, and she's making the original 1920s dresses that Jenny Sacerdote made for a modern audience. I had to buy one, Anna, I'm afraid. Because I went to Paris and I landed up buying a couture silk flapper dress from this woman. But she took me around all these amazing places in the Champs-Élysées, and it was really great fun to write. So it's all that Hemingway kind of cafe culture and jazz clubs, and it's so much fun to write. So I've written all of that kind of atmosphere, and of course there's a bit of a love story.
So let's talk actually a little bit about love stories. So when you go about writing one, how do you kind of map it out? Do you always know where it's going, or do your characters kind of tell you?
Well, I've written a lot of novels now, and I can tell you after 18 novels that planning is really important. They said that at the beginning and I didn't believe them, but actually planning is really important. You do really need to have the curve. And I do think that actually when I start off writing, the love story's always been the backbone of every single book that I've written. Mm-hmm. And the character curve from A to B, you have to set up a proper romantic curve so that you know where the character story is going, because the reader really needs to know. And it's so ingrained in us how we want a love story to go, because we need two people that are destined to each other for each other not to be able to see that. It's the classic Harry Met Sally, isn't it, when he kind of realizes on New Year's Eve, when you realize you want to spend the rest of your life with someone, you've got to do it amazing. And so that amazing writing, that amazing scene where he kind of runs across town and he remembers why he loves her, that is so ingrained in me, and I think in all readers and all romantics at heart. So that's really what I start with every book, is that kind of curve. And you really need to make sure that you've got that nailed and that you've got characters. But the characters walk in, you know, sometimes onto the page, and you can't really vouch for that. That sometimes just happens. And somebody, quite often, I think one of the things that I've really learned in all my time writing is to trust the power of my subconscious mind, because quite often your mind will have worked out for you. And I think if I had any advice to people starting writing, is that just trust that instinct, and start the scene where it's supposed to, where your brain is telling you to start, just jump right in at that point, because that's the start it needs to be. People spend a lot of time, myself included, trying to get characters into rooms. It's a lot of walking and door handles, and you know, we don't need all of that. You just need to be in the middle of the conversation. So you learn all these shortcuts. But the love story, I think, of any book is actually the key part, the backbone of every book.
And that might be romantic love also, but for many people it could be platonic love, it could be, you know, love in your family, just but that
well,
is
I've written this book because I a couple of years ago had breast cancer, and which was picked up completely unexpectedly on a random scan, and so I went through all the treatment and I landed up running on the seafront here in Brighton with a group of women who had all been through cancer treatment. And it was just the most amazing experience, because it was a big two fingers to cancer, basically, us running and laughing and the gallows humour that came out of it. And I landed up writing a book called The Cancer Ladies Running Club, which is a Josie Lloyd book, and that's coming out next May. And that will be a big book. But that is a book about the love you have for your friends. You know, that's a love story or friendship. So that was quite fun to write, sort of different take on that, and about how a group of women and a group of friends can really support each other and actually make somebody be the best person that they can be. So that was a really fun way to do it. But again, the love story of that is the key through that.
What does it mean to you to be a writer in Brighton? Would you want to be a writer anywhere else?
No. And, you know, as we're speaking, we're just sort of coming out of lockdown, aren't we? And it's actually been lovely for me. I mean, I've basically been in lockdown for 25 years. so this is normal for me. But I love being in writing. I tell you why. I really love being able to see a horizon. I lived in London for 25 years, and I really love London, but I really love being by the sea. I like walking by the sea with my dog every day. I like swimming in the sea as often as I can. I like seeing the horizon. And I also really like all the quirky characters in Brighton. And actually, one of the things that I've learnt about lockdown, and this is quite an interesting thing that I've learnt about myself, is that I'm quite a busy person. I always fill up my time with things to do. And it drives Emily, my husband, mental, because he likes to be a hermit writer. I like to fill up my time with being busy and seeing friends and doing stuff, and I'm always arranging loads of far too much. And I've always thought, oh, if only I had more time to write, if only I had loads of time, then I would get loads of brilliant work done and I'd nail the word count every day and it'd be brilliant. And actually, what I've discovered is the reverse is true, because what I really like is going out and about and seeing people, and that is what feeds my imagination. Elizabeth Gilbert said, you know, you should treat writing like a lover, that you have little snatches of, and that you have quick 15 minutes passion with, and you have like treat writing like you're having a snog in a dinner party, you know, and that it's really intense. And that's maybe the way I write, I think.
That is such a lovely ending note today. Jo, how can we find and follow you and make sure that we know where to get a copy of The Hidden Wife?
The Hidden Wife will be available on Amazon now. Joanna Rees, published by Pam Macmillan. Join me on Facebook at Joanna Rees Books. Mm-hmm. I'm also on Twitter, Jo Rees 22, and at Joanna Rees Books. Jo Rees 22 is my Instagram. Josie Lloyd Writer on the Facebook and Josie Lloyd Writer on Instagram. So come and join me. And I'm at joannareesebooks.com. So yeah, you can find me also.
Amazing. And Jo, will you come back on the show when we can be in the studio and talk about the Cancer Ladies Running Club, please?
I would be delighted to. Yes, please. I'd love that. So I will see you very soon.
Thank you so much. It's time for the actual book club section of the Brighton Book Club, and I'm really excited to be joined by two local book bloggers, Charlotte, aka The Roaming Reader, and Hannah, aka Let's Talk About Books, to talk about Andre Ackerman's Call Me By Your Name. But before we talk about that, I want to ask both of them what their favourite love stories of all time are. Hannah, what's yours?
I think it's really hard to answer that question, but I love This Modern Love, the podcast, which is loads of people write in about the different forms of love in their life, and it would be a mother and a daughter, or a son and his girlfriend, or a granddad. And I really like the range of monogamous, non-monogamous kind of love that you get out of those really wide stories, and they're also read by actors, which is like phenomenal for your ears.
Lovely. And that's also a TV show, isn't it, on Netflix?
Yes, and a book now as well. They're covering all of the mediums.
Amazing. Thank you. How about you, Charlotte?
I think my favourite is The Time Traveller's Wife. I'm not hugely into romance, but I love things that have a twist. And obviously that is hugely just different, and it's like weird structure I love. So yeah, that's my absolute favourite.
Lovely. Okay, cool. So today on our Love of All Forms special, we are talking about, like I said, Call Me By Your Name by Andre Ackerman. I'm going to read from the blurb and then we are going to discuss it. During a restless summer on the Italian Riviera, a powerful romance blooms between 17-year-old Elio and his father's house guest, Oliver. Unrelenting currents of obsession and fear, fascination and desire threaten to overwhelm the lovers, who at first feign indifference to the charge between them. What grows from the depths of their souls is a romance of scarcely 6 weeks' duration, and an experience that marks them for a lifetime. For what the two discover on the Riviera and during a sultry evening in Rome is the one thing they both already fear they may never truly find again: total intimacy. Hannah, I'm going to start by asking you what your general thoughts are and your initial thoughts are about Call Me By Your Name.
Okay, so I read Call Me By Your Name when it first released on recommendation of my mum, because she is the biggest book influence in my life. And I initially loved it. I thought I was completely wrapped up in the world. I was obsessed with the setting and made me want to go to Italy. But on further reflection, which I feel like is an important thing to do when we read, that I actually had to find parts of it quite problematic, mainly to do with the relationship with Oliver being 24 and Elio being 17. And although it is very clear from the point of view of Elio that it's consensual, I have read from other prominent members of the LGBTQI plus community that it was perpetuating some of these rhetoric we have around predatory relationships in the gay community and the idea of preying on younger, less advanced in their sexual lives, boys and women, boys and girls who are members of that community. So I had to really take a step back and think it was a privilege for me to enjoy it as a love story and for me to get wrapped up in the setting. But as someone who may be a survivor of assault or abuse or has been a member of a predatory relationship, it could be an extremely triggering book. And I'm not sure the author put that across enough for me to find that, to be able to separate the two, if that makes sense.
That is really interesting take on it. So so when you first read it, were you kind of, you know, you said you were able to just completely kind of immerse yourself in it, because the setting and the writing, I think, are absolutely kind of stunning. Charlotte, what did you think of Call Me By Your Name? And what do you think about Hannah's opinions about it? Does that affect the way that you read it?
So it's interesting because I just reread it just the past couple of days for the first time since I'd read it initially. And I totally get what you mean. Like, the love story, I think, as you say, is quite problematic. I think it's his worshipping of Oliver, which I had a little bit of a problem with, because it was so intense at the beginning. Worshipped him so much, and Oliver definitely saw that. But he didn't take advantage of it straight away. There was the gap where he kind of took stock. He allowed Elio to have his feelings and work them out. He said that he was in love with him from the beginning, but didn't act on it until like a month later. So I think it was consensual, but problematic to write about, maybe. But the thing I really love about the book, more than the love story, I think, is the whole setting. And I think it's almost more of a love story to that. It's beautiful, and the way the other characters I adore, how they just drop in and out, the extra town, the kind of feeling of the whole book, I think is really beautiful. And that kind of adds to the whole romantic vibe of it. Maybe that's what makes you think it's such a strong love story.
Yeah, I agree. I think the setting is really... the way you say it, it's like a postcard of love to that place. I can definitely see that. The other thing I have a slight problem with is that Andre Ackerman has said that he originally wrote it as a straight story and then he changed it later, which I feel like there's a lot to unpack there with you know, LGBTQ plus being a quirk or a trend that we should get on board with. And I also read that, oh, he says, it is a beautiful love story that unfolds just as it would between two straight adolescents, which I feel like is quite tone deaf in not acknowledging the differences and the struggles that are members of the LGBTQ plus community might experience when first exploring their own desire and sexuality. So I'm just not sure about the writer's intention. And obviously this book is now lauded as such a gay romance and a book that everyone should read. And the author is straight. And there's so many gay and members of the LGBTQ plus community who can't get published, whose stories aren't being told. So the fact that we're lauding over a straight white male, or he's of Egyptian heritage descent, doesn't sit right with me when there's so many stories that aren't being told.
That is, yeah, that's a really, really interesting point. And it changes completely the way that I see the book, knowing that it would be written first for a heterosexual relationship. And that's such an interesting point, because I would see it very differently if it was a slightly older guy and a younger girl, you know. And that is, and that speaks a lot to our own kind of inbuilt prejudices as well. And so it's definitely, definitely something to think about. If we do want to read, have either of you read stories by LGBT plus people that you would recommend give a more realistic depiction of love?
Yeah, I just recently finished Rainbow Milk by Paul Mendes, and he is a Black British queer author, and he writes what could be described as autofiction, but I would say there's a lot of literary content in there as well. He's writing about a character, Jesse, who leaves, who is disfellowshipped from being Jehovah's Witness, and then moves to London and becomes a sex worker, and talks about his exploration into his sexual desires and the way he lives in London compared to his life in the Black country. And it was just absolutely phenomenal. It's very emotional and very charged, but an extremely, extremely important story. I think the intersections between religion, queerness and Blackness were just really, really eye-opening to read.
I'll take that recommendation on board, because I'm really ashamed. I don't think I have, because all the homosexual relationships that I've come across in books, I think they're all written by straight people. So I will need to look into that a little bit more. Really, that's the first time I've really thought about it, and I really need to think about that more, definitely research it more.
I was just going to say, I think these are all definitely conversations that we need to be having at the moment. And I had a really good chat with another guest on the podcast earlier called Jennifer, who was talking about the portrayal of disabled people in fiction and how it can be infuriating for her to read a lot of these depictions by able-bodied non-disabled people. And that, you know, it actually, why aren't we asking, you know, why aren't we looking at writers who are disabled to tell their own stories?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think any group that is marginalised and or oppressed should be, their stories should be told by people who have those lived experiences. We had the saga of American Dirt at the start of the year, with that being a completely inappropriate use of the writer's privilege to not only perpetuate problematic stereotypes, but then hugely profit off of the back of them, I think has opened a lot of readers' eyes. And I think there's also there's something to be said about the mainstream reader and someone who maybe doesn't, like, I spend a lot of time thinking about books and reading books, and I'm sure so do you guys, but for someone who might just pick up a book in Waterstones or only reads on holiday, those, that kind of information isn't out there for them to grab when they read the book. They just think, oh, that sounds like a good story, I'll pick it up. Mm. And I think that's what we need to be talking about more, is how to get these messages out to the mainstream.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I would really recommend, I'm not sure if either of you have read Sylvia Brownwick's Pages for Her and Pages for You, which are just absolutely beautifully written. She's a gay writer, and she just writes lesbian relationships so, so beautifully, with so much nuance. And I think everybody should read them, and they're completely underrated. Okay, that's almost all we have time for today. But before we go, Hannah, what should we be reading this summer?
Okay, alongside Rainbow Milk by Paul Mendes, I would highly recommend Exciting Times, which is a coming of age story set in Hong Kong. It has a bi relationship, and it talks a lot about language and linguistics, and I absolutely adored it. And I would say the Hong Kong heat perfectly suits the summer. And second to that, I would say Ocean Vuong's On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous, which is a lyrical coming of age story from a Vietnamese immigrant talking to his mother who cannot read about the life in small town America, and it's absolutely stunning.
They both sound really, really great. Thank you very much, Hannah. And how about you, Charlotte?
I would recommend, first of all, the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society, which has been out a few years now, but with the anniversary of VE Day, I think it's quite timely. It's just really romantic. It's very relaxing. It's set on Guernsey, which is beautiful. I love it. It's really lightweight. It's really good fun. So yeah, definitely that one. And maybe if you want to go for something maybe on the other side, a touch heavier, I love Normal People, which again has, you know, with the TV series has grown in popularity again. And it talks all about mental health, and it's another kind of love story. And yeah, I love that book.
Thank you very much, both of you, for coming on today and for your time. How can we follow both of your Bookstagram accounts? Hannah?
I'm just at Let's Talk About Books, baby, and then the S in Let's is actually a Z. That's where you find me.
And how about you, Charlotte?
I'm over at The Roman Reader on Instagram.
Thank you for listening to the Brighton Book Club. Before we go, just want to do a quick shout out to New Writing South, who are doing loads of great online events over the next few months, including mentoring, talks by authors and publishers. I hope today's episode, as well as being entertaining, has also encouraged you to consider diversifying your reading list. If you're wondering where to start, local publisher Myriad Editions are releasing the paperback of New Daughters of Africa, which is an anthology of writing by women of African heritage or descent, and there's over 200 contributors to it. It's edited by Margaret Busby, and you can pre-order the paperback by Myriad's website and use the code MYREADATHOME, MYREADATHOME, for 25% off, and that is 957 pages that you can dip in and out of for, you know, the rest of your life, and you will find something in there for everyone. It's a really incredible book. Also, I want to do a quick shout out for Time for a Story, which is a new quarterly magazine, which is paired with high quality audio to stream. It's a really good antidote to the kind of disposable kids magazine culture. There's some lovely stories and really lovely audio to go alongside them. It's kind of like being read to in the nicest way possible. You can find more information at storygoblins.com. Do stay in touch with us. You can follow us on Instagram at BTN Book Club. You can email us at btnbookclub@gmail.com. Please subscribe to the podcast and rate and review it if you do like it. And if you are a local brand looking for some very affordable sponsorship, do let me know. I'm going to leave you today with a song called West Baby by local musician Marissi Music, who is one of my oldest friends and a very, very talented man. And I will see you all next month.
In a world of more division or wisdom, too many isms. Corrupted systems always fall on us, the victims. With trust, because this is just the world that we're living in. There is no moral compass, and our country has a bigger sin. Except for the West, maybe, not me, even though I am a West baby. Living in this Babylon, you know it gets crazy. That's why we bun herbs and we get wavy. 4936 nil, we just chill. Bill, yeah, Bill's all I've been all ill will. 4936 nil, we just chill. Bill, yeah, Bill's all I've been all ill will. Late nights at the cemetery gates, just trying to read the future. You can either be a winner or you'll be a loser. I'm not trying to be a worm, I'm trying to be a rooster. Making new music on an old computer, cause time keeps rushing and wondering will I get there. I rest barely and sometimes it gets scary. I have to remind myself I'm blessed or I'm stressed out, I get low. Breathe in and let go and let's go. Small things make the biggest difference. I take it step by step and make it bigger and bigger until you get that check. I'm still in the rat race, I haven't left that yet. And I'll always have faith so I can bet my death. In the West maybe, maybe Africa, but still I am a West baby. Living in this Babylon, you know it gets crazy. That's why we bun herbs and we get wavy. 4936 nil, we just chill. Bill, yeah, Bill's all I've been all ill will. 4936 nil, we just chill. Bill, yeah, Bill's all I've been all ill will. I'm under, humble, move like Black Mamba. Blues and the stands are too juicing. Take me back to FUBU and Bluetooth. Alize Blue in the alleyway with my dude Rude. Trying to find the next party a long time before Polo and Ed Hardy. When everything mattered but it did. life has the pattern, got the vision clear. In the West I seek fortune and a couple big ladies. Living in this Babylon, I just want stability. That's why I bun up and I deal with synergy.
Dream.